early stage organ have three or four buttons.
Yeah.
Then play by hand, you know. Melody.
Yeah.
Bongo, yeah, conga.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, by hand, so.
Yeah, so it's difficult.
Difficult. So why not automatic, no?
Howdy do, Sparks fans. This is your friendly neighborhood podcast host, Christian Huey, and this podcast is All You Ever Think About is Sparks. It's the 37th episode, and this will be the third consecutive episode that we'll be discussing the 1982 album Angst in My Pants. Yes, it's already a three-parter. Well, surprise, it's going to be a four-parter, because Monty, Malin, and I, again, just had so much to say about it. This is going to be a pretty brief introduction here. I just want to take this opportunity to give a shout out to some other Sparks fans that I've gotten to know and work with really well, and they've all got their own Sparks fan projects. In some cases, they've got more than one going. But, of course, my good friend Monty Malin, whose voice you'll be hearing in a few minutes here on this pod, has started a brand new YouTube show all about Sparks, of course. It's called Sparks Entertainment and Art, and I have the distinct honor of being his first guest, and we'll be recording that later this evening. Of course, you know about our good friend, Paul Barrett. He still has Metasparks on YouTube, and he's been adding a lot of great new content to that. Penny, who's been on the show once or twice, she has a blog at Sparks Talk by Penny. That's P-E-N-N-Y, Sparks Talk by Penny. It's a mouthful. .blogspot.com. And I highly recommend you check out some of her stuff. Some of it's kind of long form for blog posts, meaning it's probably about the equivalent of, you know, five or six typed pages, but she's got just absolutely incredible prose, and it's the kind of work that she does you would really hope would make its way into some sort of official encyclopedia or biography about Sparks one day. And of course, we have Mr. Andy Moore. Haven't had him on the show yet. We've got to remedy that. Andy had at least one episode solely about Sparks on his excellent podcast, Andy's Treasure Trove. So go check out all that stuff, folks. Next episode, Monty and I will be finally wrapping up our talk about Angst in My Pants, and I will also have a bit of a conversation that I had with a Welsh Sparks fan named Timothy Hall all about New Wave Era Sparks. So, without further ado, dance goddammit. When Sparks reemerged as a touring band in 1981, Ron Mayall was eager to road test some of the newer, more compact, and portable synths he used on that year's album, Womp That Sucker. If you were lucky enough to be in the crowd during a Sparks show during that time, you would have gotten used to seeing the name Roland emblazoned upon Ron's keyboard, a branding feature that was printed on the console by the factory. You also likely would have noticed that at some point, and certainly by the time Sparks took their follow-up album, Angst in My Pants, on the road, that Ron had cheekily rearranged the letters to spell Ronald, branding the instrument as his own, at least in spirit. Womp's credits list a crate full of synths as Ron's keyboard arsenal. The Yamaha CS80, the Polymoog, the Yamaha Grand, the Wurlitzer electric piano, and the Roland JP4. The credits on Angst in My Pants are less forthcoming about which tools remained in Ron's toolbox, but based on a May 1983 interview with Keyboard Magazine, and its prominence on stage as Ronald's Ronald, the then brand new Roland Jupiter 8 quickly became Ron's one board to rule them all. "That synthesizer," Ron told Keyboard Magazine, "and what Mac could get through the board took care of whatever sound we really needed." While Jim Goodwin hauled a Prophet 5 on stage to fill up whatever space there was left over in the absence of Max studio overdubs, Ron stuck by his Jupiter 8. He even started bringing two of them on the road with the band. Not to be flash, he explained to Keyboard Magazine, but just for panic's sake. You know, in case one of them malfunctioned. And they sometimes did. Compared to the modular dinosaur that was the Moog 3P that was used on 1979's Number One in Heaven, the Jupiter 8 required no external modules. It was sleek and compact, and as opposed to the Moog's strict monophony, the J8 could feature up to 8 simultaneous voices or notes. You could even split the duties of the 61-key layout in half, playing one patch on the bass half and a separate patch on the higher half. Here's Depeche Mode multi-instrumentalist Alan Wilder demonstrating this very feature back in 1982.
Another nice feature is you can split the keyboard in two and have two separate sounds. For example, in the lower half of the keyboard I can put a bass kind of sound, and in the upper half a stringy sound or whatever. And there's one song we do called Torah where I do that. I'm playing a one half.
Ron Mayall was far from the only contemporary pop musician to swear by the Roland Jupiter 8. Depeche Mode either, for that matter. According to Reverb.com, the Jupiter 8 was a go-to synth for much of the 80s, appearing on records by Duran Duran, Michael Jackson, Howard Jones, Tears for Fears, ABBA, Queen, Marvin Gaye, and many others. It was a staple in studios and often used by producers for its clean sound and ability to fit comfortably in a mix. Ron Mayall called the kinds of sounds to come out of the J8, quote, rich and gutsy. That rich and gutsiness was a characteristic of the types of sounds that top-of-the-line analog synths were and are still known for. And this stood in contrast to the sharper, tinnier, chimier sounds coming out of the newer, cheaper digital synths like the Yamaha DX7 or the Synclavier. Given the Roland Jupiter 8's omnipresence in the keyboard-based pop music scene of the 80s, it may be surprised to hear that its creator wasn't really, even really a musician, nor was his name Roland, or Jupiter, or any English-sounding name at all. The entire Roland line of instruments was made possible by Ikutaro Kakahashi, a businessman and engineer born in Osaka, Japan in 1930. Imperial Japan's rapid industrialization, particularly since their participation with the Allies in World War I, brought with it a host of public health crises. Tuberculosis was a big one. And, sadly, it claimed the lives of both of Kakahashi's parents when he was only a year old. Kakahashi was then raised by his grandparents, who encouraged his early studies in electrical engineering. What young Taro was really interested in, though, was music. However, music education wasn't available to him, so he relied on listening to the radio for his exposure to music. His home was destroyed under Allied bombing during World War II, so a teenage Taro Kakahashi fled to the island of Kyushu and opened up a watch repair shop, hoping to attend university once the war ended. Those plans were stymied, though, as harsh post-war conditions led to Taro himself contracting tuberculosis. He would have died, as his parents did, had he not spent 4 years in a sanitarium and eventually having his life saved by hundreds of daily injections of the experimental antibiotic streptomycin. While convalescing, Kakahashi taught himself English and listened to music on the radio when he could, taking particular interest in American jazz greats like Duke Ellington. Once healthy again, Kakahashi resumed his watch repair business, adding radio and television repair to his list of services. His love of music intensified, and although he never did learn to play an instrument, he quickly sought to merge his knowledge of electronics with his desire to hear and to play music. In 1964, he founded his first company, Ace, with a focus on manufacturing electrical organs, with innovations like the AutoCord. He grew restless and sold off Ace in 1971 in order to start a new company with an eye toward the global market. He named the new company Roland, by his admission, because he just liked the soft, brown sound of it. And one thing he really wanted to do was to create instruments that could be accessible by not just professionals, but by amateurs and people who perhaps were not necessarily even experienced musicians. Over the next couple of decades, Takahashi's work through Roland would be responsible for some of the biggest innovations in electronic music and in the larger music industry. Among his most celebrated inventions were the TR-808 drum machine and the 303 bass machine, the Jupiter 8, three genre-defining pieces of gear that are all still used today and coveted by those who have yet to do so. Takahashi also revolutionized the recording industry with the invention of the MIDI standard of digital communication between electronic instruments and computers. He finally did earn a Grammy Award in 2013 for this invention. Throughout his life, Takahashi was a dedicated member of the National Association of Music Merchants, or NAMM, and he attended their trade shows almost every year for about 50 years. You can hear lengthy interviews with Takahashi in English on NAMM's website. Much of the information relayed here is gleaned from those sources. Takahashi passed away of natural causes in 2017 at the age of 87. His preeminence among influential figures in late 20th and early 21st century music is as undeniable as it was improbable. So, the next time you see Ron Mayall's splendidly spindly fingers dancing upon the keys of his Ronald machine, remember Taro Takahashi. Arigato gozaimasu. Sparks fans, this is All You Ever Think About is Sparks. I believe this is now episode 37. We are we're still on Angst in My Pants, which I have no problem with. It's one of my favorite albums of all time. We're finally gonna broach the subject of the second half of the vinyl platter, and I have with me, as always, or at least as usual, Mr. Monty Mallon. How you doing, Monty?
Great. I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
It's been a surprisingly long time since we've talked for this particular show. So since then, I don't even know if we've discussed you saw them in DC, was it sometime, or was it Pittsburgh? Or
yeah, DC Philly? And Philadelphia.
So you saw two shows.
DC and Philadelphia, and you saw them in Austin. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. There you go. Yeah. I'm just wondering, and I won't belabor this, but was there anything about either of the shows that you saw that you thought stood out or were surprising?
Well, the Philadelphia show was wonderful. The DC show was transcendent. The band was so tight. They were tight the last time when Russell was all yellow, but
was,
they were just
why was
somehow,
he yellow?
He was wearing a whole yellow outfit.
Gotcha.
On the last tour. Right. But I thought they were somehow they took it to an even higher level, which was amazing because I didn't think there was one. And I have to say, hearing a couple of those deep tracks like Toughest Girl in Town, always one of my favorite Sparks songs on an album that I'm not that crazy about, but that song I particularly love.
What a surprise.
Treat that was. Total surprise. As well as Beaver O'Lindy. I mean, those were amazing to hear them. And then Bon Voyage was just such a treat because that's one of my top top songs. So
I don't remember.
But then the best part about it is that my whole family was with me and some friends. And for some reason, we were on the floor. And for some reason, things just opened up right at the front. So we all just went down and just hung out for half the show. Joe was there and Rob Seeger. And we just hung out for, I guess, the last 7 or 8 songs, all of us together. Just, you know, like in the olden days when you're a kid and you're like right up at the stage and there they are.
Yeah,
it was just so powerful and so wonderful. So really wonderful experience. Really wonderful show. A+.
How were the venues?
Well, the venues were fine. In Philadelphia, we were right behind the soundboard. So yeah. I told everybody I was with, well, one thing I can guarantee, we're going to have great sound tonight. And we did. And at the other show, the venue is one where they've played 3 or 4 times now. I've seen them. I first saw them there as part of FFS. And it's a terrific venue, the Lincoln Theater here in Washington. And the acoustics are great. And the band was happy and having fun. And it was all good.
Nice. Really cool.
Anything
really
you
cool.
Say about Austin?
It was great. It was at the, so here in Austin over the last few years, the name Moody has popped up in several different venues. So it can be confusing which Moody Theater you're going to. The one that we went to is downtown, and that's where they film, their, Austin City Limits shows. So I believe this is going to be an official Austin City Limits taping. I looked it up. I haven't seen anything about it yet, but I'm still holding out hope.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, it really would be. It was, packed audience. It was unlike, you know, most of the other rock shows, you know, that I've been to. Of course, there was no opening act, and those guys, they started 6 minutes after the time. It was 8:06 when they went on. So there was no messing around. Of course, I did sneak a peek at what the playlist would be, the set list would be from other shows. So there weren't a whole lot of surprises there, but it still was a lot of fun. Russ put on a cowboy hat in the somewhere near the end of it, and then he addressed us all as y'all and whatever. It reminded me a bit of the story about them back in the old days, playing some dates in Texas with the original band, when I think Russ had a hat on. I think that was around the time he threw that mallet up and it bonked him in the head. But it was cool, man. Yeah, they did a couple of encores. The audience, there's not a lot of shows that I have seen where I look to my left and I look to my right and everybody is singing along, you know, or at least mouthing the lyrics. You know, that's how you know you've got a band with a hardcore following.
That's a hardcore following, yeah.
That was a hardcore
following.
It's so
cool how it's grown, isn't it?
It was great. I think my favorite performance was My Baby's Taking Me Home.
Yeah.
It was just transcendent. And the light setup that they have was really great. I'd like to know who was responsible for that. They did a hell of a job.
It's funny you'd mention that because, I knew the set list, too. I'm okay with that. I don't have any pretense to not having an interest in that. And I knew the set list. And it was great. But when they did So May We Start, and after when he does his leap, after, you know, about a third of the way through the song, and all the lights go spark, spark, sparks, you know, in the background. And everybody goes nuts in the audience. And I remember thinking to myself, for the first time I saw him, I remember thinking, oh, this is Sparks on a big budget. Interesting.
Yeah.
At least a real budget.
Good for him. It did feel kind of widescreen cinematic in a way. And also good to see Stevie Nistor there, back there on the drums banging away. I knew he had some health issues a couple of years back.
Love that guy.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah. All right. So here we are. Angst in my pants.
Yeah.
The second half of Angst in My Pants. So before we get into, you know, the songs and, you know, do the thing where we dissect and whatnot. I did take a bunch of notes that, you know, and please jump in if you were, you know, seeing any of this at the time from that era.
But Christian, before you do,
there's
a couple things that I want to tell you. These are pre-notes to your notes. All
please.
Right? There's just a couple things. First, I didn't get to hear the introduction that you did for the last show until I actually heard the show where you talked about Taxi, and then you tied it all together in such a way that you drew some parallel to Sparks and their the cast members of the show and all that. And I just got to tell you, for the record, it was brilliant exposition.
Get out of here.
It was. I loved listening to every word of it and the way you tied it together. It was great. It was really great.
I appreciate that.
I just appreciate all the time you put into this, because that's what really makes this so special, I think.
Well, thank
you. It was great. It was really
lovely. Thank you so much. And sometimes it's a reach. I thought that one was a bit of a reach, but not so much of a reach, because I mentioned somewhere in there that I had read that Danny DeVito had visited Sparks in their hotel room during the week leading up to the taping of that week's Saturday Night Live recording. And it was in the Easley book, as it turns out. Hang on a second. Notes back up. It was in the Easley book, and it was a quote from David Kendrick. It was David.
Never go anywhere without it.
Boom! There it is. Yes. Yeah, it was David who had said that the hotel that they were staying in, let's see, he said Muhammad Ali was staying there the same time they were there. I don't think they met one another, but he was there. They did meet Andy Warhol, and there was a photo floating around that I saw. Danny DeVito visited them on multiple occasions over there. So I got to believe that the guy is to some degree a Sparks fan.
That comes across on the show that he's genuine. My guess is he's the reason they were on the show. You know, he said, hey,
that's what I thought too.
Yeah. But well, did you see anything that said otherwise, or
no,
do you think that that's probably right? I think he said that I want these guys on the show. They really deserve it. They'll be great. And then they were.
I would love that to be the case. I don't have anything to say that was the case, but that's going to be my headcanon that Danny DeVito was in some way largely responsible for getting Sparks on SNL. May 15th, 1982.
I think so. But I don't know. I don't really know. But yeah, they seem to have a natural rapport. And I can see it.
Oh, yeah.
I can see Ron and Dan hanging out and just making a lot of cynical comments sitting in a bar or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. They've got, similar in that.
Well, it was great. Actually,
go on.
I was going to say some of the nuance may have been lost on the non-American listeners to your show.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think they probably enjoyed it too, just because it's such an interesting exposition that you did.
So, yeah, I thought so.
But it was great.
Thank you. Yeah, it was actually because of all that I finally started watching the sitcom, the recent one. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which I had never really watched before, but then I started to.
I've watched a lot of it, and you know, I used to watch it sporadically, and then a few years ago I said, why don't I just watch this from beginning to end? It's kind of fun. And it was fun, but after about three or four seasons, I was like, I kind of got it, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not a criticism of the show. It's just that there's a way it unfolds that's kind of similar in a lot of the episodes. So I kind of got it, and I never quite finished it, but it can be a very funny show.
So Danny DeVito, Ron and Russ, consummate outsiders, a bit of cynicism, but lots of comedy, good-hearted people, and let's celebrate that.
Yeah. But then there's the second thing I want to say is that I noticed on the last show, I said a couple things, like when I was referring to their catalog, I called it a category. And I noticed that I referred to the internet, which really hadn't existed then.
Right.
So I just want to say, if you're getting like emails from folks saying, hey, I'm really worried about Monty, you know, I'm worried about your co-host. Is he okay? Let him know I am. Let him know I am, but I'm just old. Could you do that?
I don't know why they would say that about you over me, but okay. I'll
well, I'm the old one. Keep that in mind. Sometimes silly things. Okay.
I'll reassure my 11s of fans.
If you could let me know, you know, so we can, I'll send them a note. That would be great.
You got it. That's it. So, all right. Angst in my pants. So where I'm going to take this from, just from my notes before we get into the songs themselves, is my notes last time, I think I led up to the actual release of the album.
Did you freeze up?
And so I just want to say a few things, and please, you know, and I'm jump in if you have personal experience or any personal knowledge about any of this stuff. Of course, when it was released by Atlantic Records. I believe they're the same ones who released Want That Sucker. They vigorously promoted this album, I think, in large part because of how much they were taking off in L.A. and through K-Rock. So they ran full-page ads in a bunch of music papers. The L.A. Times had a huge full-page ad about it. It was the second ever Sparks album to break the top 200. It charted at 173 on the Billboard 200. Okay, but even though they did relatively well in the States, it did absolutely nada in the Europe or in the UK. And I read that I don't know if they were planned to appear or just, you know, lobbied to get onto the old gray whistle test, but that never did come to fruition. Let's see. This album, however, Hollywood seemed to take some notice because you got the Valley Girl movie, asked Sparks to put some of their music on the soundtrack and in the film. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about there?
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see the movie? I think
No, I haven't. I've seen bits and pieces of it. I think Angst is on there, and maybe one or two others.
Eaten by the Monster,
right?
Love it is on there too.
So and I can't get myself to watch Valley Girl, but I should for completeness.
This weekend, you know, we're all busy people. I said I should sit down and watch Valley Girl. Well, I ended up just watching a few YouTube clips. Where they used the songs, and Eaten by the Monster of Love was in a scene where I guess, I don't know if he's the main character or whatever, but there's a high school age guy and he's riding his bike and he goes into the house uninvited of the girl that he's into, sneaks upstairs and, you know, watches her through frosted glass, taking a shower. And all that has Eaten by the Monster of Love underneath it.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of scenes like that in funny adolescent movies these days, do you?
No, you don't. There's not a lot of Porky's these days.
There's not a lot of Porky's these days, is there?
Very true. So, no, I didn't see the whole movie, but apparently they Ron and Russ negotiated with Universal Pictures. Like, they seem to have a pretty good negotiating hand. And the way Russ tells it, he told this to a magazine some 15 or so years ago, that someone came and delivered by FedEx, once they had negotiated everything, a lump of cash. And Russ is counting the cash, you know, afterward. And here you go, Ron, check it out. And so that was a major plus for them.
I never heard that story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, take it with some amount of salt, I suppose. You never know if they're having us on. And a few songs from that album have sort of
Venmo it over.
Venmo it over, right. Okay. A few songs from that album have popped up here and there in TV shows and in movies as well. I found a few. Most of them are kind of B movies, but let's see. There was Eaten by the Monster of Love showed up in an episode of the Gilmore Girls.
Yep,
and that was a pretty popular show. There's this show on Showtime called Yellow Jackets. That's a pretty decent show, and they played Angst in My Pants on that one. So it's kind of see how there neat to see how there's been some staying power from some of the songs on that album.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some of the later songs have shown up on shows and things too, but it seems like with that album, it really resonated. You know, this is a good soundtrack kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure it helped. And, you know, maybe we have K-Rock to thank for a lot of this, but in L.A., they were getting a lot of visibility. And in L.A., on L.A. radio, they were getting a lot of circulation. So Hollywood being right there, you know, I'm sure was really helpful to them.
Yeah, that's a great point.
When they, let's see here. So we mentioned the SNL thing, and I gave a whole spiel about that in a previous episode. One thing that I was curious about was did Disney give a shit at all about using Mickey Mouse? You can imagine these days that, you know, their lawyers would be up in arms, and that was actually something that David Kendrick himself personally was concerned about. And apparently
I'm recalling from a very long time ago that they referenced that in one of the old newsletters. I could look it up.
Really?
I remember there was some reference to that. Maybe it was just a reference that they were worried about it or something like that. Maybe it was a joking reference. But they did follow that up with Minnie Mouse.
Yeah, yeah.
Which seemed to be sanctioned or seemed to be, you know, okay.
Really?
Yeah, let's look it up. I don't want to go by my memory.
Yeah, that's not a song I know a whole lot about. Was that a B-side on the next album?
I don't remember when it was released, but I think
it was 83.
It's a great little tune.
Yeah.
Minnie
Mouse. Yeah, it was really cute. I'm just going to talk just a little bit about the tour that they did in 82, starting in the summer after the release of the album. They did 30, can't read it here. They did 30 some odd shows, it looks like, all in the U.S., but for one in Toronto. They weren't able to do anything outside of the U.S. And again, this comes from David. Most of the audiences, he noticed, especially the closer you get to the West Coast, the newer the audience and the younger the audiences were. And that's when they played, everything was from Angst and Womp.
Yeah.
And there weren't a lot of older fans who knew the older stuff. As they went further out into the country, Chicago, Texas, Kansas City, you started seeing some of the older fans. And that's where they started to play some of the older island hits and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this on the earlier show, so forgive me if I did, but that was the first tour that I saw them. And there were one or two of the older stuff thrown in, but it was almost all Angst in My Pants and Womp That Sucker.
So you saw them at that tour?
That was the first tour. I saw them. That's the first time I saw them at the Agora in Cleveland, and then at the 930 Club in Washington. And it was almost all, It was Sextown USA followed by Funny Face, and it just hit on those two albums, with the last song being Wacky Women, which is a wonderful way to end.
That's a great way to go out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they went out, then they came back, and I think the encore was Upstairs. So it was all high energy. It was a great show, and it was great. It was really, for me, it was just wonderful after all those years.
How did that performance compare to the ones that you saw a few years before?
Well, that was the first time I'd seen them.
Oh, that was?
Yeah. Okay. That was the first time I'd seen them. And I was a big fan of that band, the David Kendrick, Bob Haig, Les Boehm band. I was a big fan of it. So, you know, I wasn't expecting, you know, anything more than what I got or different from what I got. And they came out and they rocked. You know, I mean, they definitely had it together. And that band, I remember one thing that David Kendrick told me in the interview that I did with him was that even as the albums went on with, In Outer Space and some of the others and Pulling Rabbits, and then even with Music That You Can Dance To, the band, as the albums were varying quality and different than the first two, the band just stayed hot and got hotter and hotter as they played. For and sure. He said he just, while he wasn't crazy about some of the output on the albums, the live performance never faltered and was always something he loved. So that band was totally great, as far as I'm concerned.
There's some,
that's
some
a quotes big point that... about this album, though. I mean, yeah. You know, and we'll talk about this more, and we have talked about it. This is a real band sounding album, and if you yeah. read, that's confirmed by the Isley book and some of the other things that they were in the room together when they were recording this. And it's, you know, I really am looking forward to our conversation about, I know I'm taking away from what you wanted to say. I'm really looking forward to our conversation about In Outer Space. I think that's a really more important album than sometimes is given credit for. But that was where they started to say, here's what we want to do in the song. Let's bring in the drummer. Let's bring in the guitarist, which is what they do a lot now. Whereas with this album and its predecessor, the band was there. Mm-hmm. And they would play every day. Kendrick said that they played every day together in their hotel, and they were always on call, is the way he put it, because they were staying in the hotel right above the recording studio.
In Musicland Studios.
Yeah.
And
so
in most,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, from what I understand, and for most of those songs, I believe on both of those albums, it was the band and the music that came first. And in many cases, Ron would be up in the hotel room. Yeah. Ron would be up in the hotel room finishing up the lyrics a day or two before recording.
Yeah.
So the music came first.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I thought so too. Ron was also, very interested during this tour, making it, more visually interesting or arresting, is what he said. This is where he debuted his Ron Shuffle. And this is a quote from Ron about that Ron Shuffle, which I hadn't come across before. "I wanted to move in a way that was not considered a part of the pop music repertoire. And being a fan of old musicals, I tried to copy the way old geezers moved."
And he wasn't even an old geezer at the time.
He was 30-something, right?
Yeah.
This is also the tour where he took his relatively new keyboard, his synthesizer, the Roland Jupiter 8, which just did, and I did a lot of research on this particular synthesizer because that's kind of my thing. I did some research on this, and versus the synth that they were using back in 79 and even in 80, this thing was portable. It was not monophonic. It was polyphonic, up to 8 voices. There was so much more he could do with this thing. You could tell he was in love with this instrument. And that's the instrument that he took the Roland and rearranged the letters into Ronald, which you still see to this day.
He still does that. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Lots of 30 some odd shows. They did the Greek Theater in LA. They had some interesting support acts. The Red Hot Chili Peppers were one of their support acts at the Greek Theater back in 1982 when they were real, real youngins. I'm still straining to comprehend how you can go from one band to the other in one night, but very cool. The shows that they did at the Whiskey A Go Go, which of course they did way back in the day. This time, when they were welcomed back, they were allowed to choose their own opening acts, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
and the whole tour seemed to culminate in a show. Or a day. I think I read they did 2 shows in one day, I believe, at Magic Mountain in Santa Monica, California, on October 30th. Which I didn't realize this, but this is where they staged their performance for the movie Roller Coaster.
Right.
Had no idea.
You know, it's so interesting. I've been in touch with a couple folks who are living that era. in LA. One of them is somebody who I know personally here in the DC area. And then the other one is our friend Pody Cat, who's, you know, a friend of the podcast.
Oh, we were just talking today.
Yes. She has so much to say about that era and pictures. And for her, it was, you know, living it, going to Magic Mountain, going to these shows with her friends and just seeing it. What a cool experience that must have been.
Yeah.
You know, because they were so hot in LA. They were so hot thanks to K-Rock. And, you know, it was that must be really fun to go just when Sparks are part of the scene, you know, as opposed to that. You don't get that anymore. You don't get that kind of thing.
I think it's also kind of interesting that they played a song like Mickey Mouse miles, just a handful of miles away from Disneyland. And here they are at Six Flags, a competitor.
You know, I'm sure Ron thought about the irony of that.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. So, and that was filmed, I read. So that exists out there somewhere. The taping of that show.
They never released their stuff.
I know, man. So that show in particular had a lot of younger. When I say younger fans, I mean there were kids there. You know, it's a theme park. There were a lot of kids there, and Sparks welcomed this. And this is, I wanted to read this quote because there's a whole cottage industry among us, and maybe even including you and myself, of overanalyzing Ron's lyrics. Russell said this in 1983 to BAM magazine about these newer, younger fans. The people who have the most trouble dealing with what we've been doing are the ones who analyze so much. The older rock fans, in quotes, they tend to outguess our motives, and there are no ulterior motives. At our concerts now, you see these really, really young kids, and they get it for what it is, get the essence of the lyrics. Which I thought was interesting.
I think he's right.
Yeah, I think he tends to be right there for sure. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to get into the whole, the overanalyzing lyrics discussion here, but I don't think they, at this point, as I said over and over, they were just trying to sell records.
Sure.
They had a couple of visionary moments, but they weren't visionaries yet. You know, they weren't the prophets. And at this point, they were just trying to sell records, and they hit in LA, so they stayed there and they made LA music.
With a hell of a band, and Ron can't help being Ron. So he's still got clever bon mots and things in the songs.
Well, they happen to write great music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. K-Rock, we mentioned K-Rock. Well, they published its end of the year roundup in December of 1982. And just like the year before, Sparks were on this list, but this time they broke the top 10. I Predict came out at number 7. So they were just on fire thanks to, awesome, to K-Rock in L.A. Let's see. I mentioned Valley Girl and the Universal Pictures thing. I think I also mentioned in my intro for the last episode, but ABC came up to them and asked if they might write a theme song for a proposed live-action version of Modesty Blaze. And they, of course, you know, recorded their demo of Modesty Blaze and submitted it to them. And from what I read, the producers really liked it. And for a long time, that was planned to be the theme song. But I guess the studio bigwigs intervened at some point and nixed it. And instead, you know, just had some session musicians do some generic Hollywood type of soundtrack. And I'm not saying this is why, but the pilot tanked, and of course it went nowhere.
That's interesting, because I always had the impression that they liked Sparks' music and that was going to be the theme, and it had nothing to do with the music.
Oh, really?
You know, but you may be right. But well, I had always had a different impression on
that. I may be crazy. Yeah, I could be up there. Sorry, it's a Billy Joel.
I won't be joining you for the Billy Joel podcast.
I think we talked about that once.
You'll have to find another person.
Gotcha. All right. When I get to the Billy Joel podcast, I'll shop around. But I guess the demo leaked or it was sent out to some folks because there was a French record company who picked it up and decided to release it, the demo version, as a single in France, and then it was also released in Germany. I think in France it was released by an extended version of the song, and then in Germany it was released with Mickey Mouse. So, weird piece of trivia there. Of course, we know that an album released, it, you know, didn't happen until music that that you can dance music to.
Yeah.
So I have opted not to talk much about the song until we get to music you can dance to, unless you had anything.
No, I've always liked the song, you know. We can save it.
Sounds good. Let's see. I mentioned the Old Gray Whistle Test. I mentioned the Whiskey a Go-Go. Oh, this part is a bit interesting. So one of those gigs at the Whiskey a Go-Go was actually recorded by the London Wavelength Company, somehow affiliated with the BBC. So they released part of that concert on a radio promotion album of the BBC Rock Hour. So even though Sparks was doing nothing around that time in the UK, BBC released this thing in some form or another. And even though Sparks played, you know, several songs that were hits from the island years in UK, like Something for the Girl, Amateur Hour, Propaganda, I think Beat the Clock was in there. Not sure how big that was in the UK, but they did that as well. The only songs that were released on this compilation that was only for British ears were songs from the latest two albums, which had like no cachet, which was an interesting
decision. What year was this?
1982.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Maybe they're, were they, no, if it was BBC, I don't, that's kind of odd.
Yeah. It is odd. And again, and that's just going from, you know, one of my, you know, usual sources there. That's not from Root or anything. So I'm not sure what more there is to say about that.
Maybe Ron and Russ said to them, you only can release the new stuff because that's what we're promoting right now.
That is a possibility, or Joe Fleury, or yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Apparently there was also some buzz that got to Sparks that, that Japan was, getting interested in the band as well. So there was some talk, is all I know, about doing a mini tour in Japan, but that never did materialize. And the final note that I have here about all this stuff was, but you didn't know this, Ron was asked by the producers to audition for the role as the main villain in Airplane 2.
I did not know that.
So I assume he auditioned, and the role went to Sonny Bono.
Oh, that would have been so great.
I know. Isn't that some, that's bizarre stuff right there.
I would own that movie then.
Yeah, yeah.
I currently do not own it.
I think the last time I saw it was 15 or so years ago. There are a couple of funny parts. It was nice seeing William Shatner. Yeah.
Sure. No, they're funny movies.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Airplane's great.
Yeah, well, the first one, forget about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That one was fantastic. All right. That's all I have. So they finished out the rest of the year. They played a few sporadic gigs. But I mentioned Eden by the Monster of Love was actually released as a single. Apparently it was released as a single. Of course, didn't go anywhere. And at the beginning, at the top of the next year, they went off to Belgium to record their next album, which we'll talk about next time.
Yes, for sure.
So, side two, track one, we got Mustache.
Mustache. I have a story to tell about this
Please.
Song. Do you want me to jump in,
I
or
do
you want me to? It's a fine song. It's a good rocker. It's not one of my favorites on the album. I think side one, as we talked about last time, it's just from beginning to end, in my humble opinion,
just
flawless.
Yeah.
Flawless. Yeah. But this is a good song. And I like it and I enjoy it. And a friend of mine named Jamie and I, back in graduate school, we would play these Spark songs at parties and we would do just the chords, you know. He would just do the chords on pianos and I would sing to the extent that you could call it singing. And it was just for fun. And I remember one night we were doing this and we played this song and apparently we really hurt somebody's feelings because a couple of people were very upset. I think there was a woman who was in tears because of the line, when I trim it really small, my Jewish friends will never call.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I still remember to this day that they left the party. They were so worked up about it. It was a different, you know, that's what happened. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's funny. It just shows you how people can respond to certain things. I mean, that was obviously hit something with them.
I could understand.
Yeah.
Many ways in which that might be, especially 40 years ago, being closer to World War II.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's a fine song. You know, I've always enjoyed it. And what are your thoughts about it?
So I had a thought a couple of days ago that I hadn't had before. And that's that it reminds me a little bit of the Who's My Generation.
Can hear that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Take some stretching. And
no.
There, the mop, 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 mustache, mustache, right. Mustache, mustache, right. Mop, 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 yeah. Mop. That stuttering, intentional stuttering to get to the word that you want to say, like it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's Ron's mustache. Like, I'm imagining, you know, or you don't even have to imagine. Anyone who had seen Sparks in the first decade and a half or so of them, one of the first things that they notice is Ron's mustache. Why has he got the Hitler mustache, right?
Right.
And he finally decided, I'm just going to dress this head on or make a joke out of it or whatever. And maybe even blow it up and put in a wink or a nod to my generation. Was that his intent? I can't say. But I'm just saying that I can hear a little bit of that, which was funny to me.
There's the bigger point, though, is that it's kind of funny that he took it on, because that they were always a band that was very not only the music, but also the visuals. You know, they had always had a visual sense about them. And once that mustache caught on, they didn't say, oh, you know, we're on top of the pops and people are John Lennon or other people are saying, you know, there's a bloke on the TV that looks like Hitler. They didn't say, okay, I better get rid of that or I better grow it out. Because at that point, it wasn't a brand, right?
Right.
And that would have been a perfectly natural reaction. But instead, what they did was they played it up.
Yeah.
That's pretty ballsy.
It is ballsy. You know?
It is ballsy. Yeah.
It is real ballsy.
Yeah, so they deserve credit for that. They talked about it like as a Charlie Chaplin mustache, but
right, you know, or Oliver Hardy.
Whichever
had the mustache, yeah.
Yeah, but you couldn't escape the fact that it was a Hitler mustache.
Exactly.
You know, I remember thinking, I wish he didn't have that mustache. You know, it kind of bothered me, but it was, I understand, you know, whatever. It was the context of the band. But it is a funny song. I mean, there's no question about the quality of the writing of the song. The lyrics are really great. They're funny from the very beginning. You know, I mean, a lady gets a lot of things, you know, but the one thing she can't have is a mustache.
It's a mustache.
You know, right from the very beginning, it hits you and it's a funny song. You know,
it is.
I like that.
So in minute, you've probably seen this on YouTube. Or something. That's where I first saw it, of course. But apparently, have you seen the video? It's very simple. It's just a black and white. It's on video, and Ron is shaving off the mustache as the song plays. Yeah. And
I thought where you were going with that is that it inspired you.
Oh, okay. Well, sure. So I did. That was a school project. But yeah. Yeah, I did a similar thing. I grew a mustache for a play earlier this year, and my thought was to set the shaving of that mustache from different vantages on different cameras to the song, and still proud of that.
It's funny. Please make sure there's a link to it for people.
I will. Okay. I'll make sure to add a link to that. So they actually projected that video of Ron just shaving that mustache in some of those some of the shows they did during that tour, and he got rid of that mustache the next year, didn't he? Changed it to a different mustache.
I don't remember the chronology exactly, but it had run its course.
Yeah,
it had run its course. So yeah, but he always kept a mustache.
He did always keep a mustache. That's true.
Yeah. It ran its course. Yeah.
Musically, what do you think about it?
It's a fun band song. I don't have any particular additional observations or anything. I really like the fact when they play with the full band. That's something that I like. So
it's got some of the start-stop aspect that I predict has in a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, when you hear "A Lady Gets a Lot of Things," it's just the band punching here and there, bump a dump a dump, in unison.
But you know, another point which we talked about last time, and which you really see changed on the next album, is it has that anthemic quality.
Exactly, anthemic.
This is when they were writing the everything had kind of like not everything, but a lot of what they did had that big anthemic quality, clearly made to be played live and fun and loud and sloppy and get everybody moving. And this song definitely has that quality.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I think I commented about this on the last album too. But a lot of these songs are not so hard to pick up and play. If people who are not expert musicians, like this song is mostly in power chords. It's in C. Mm-hmm. You can play it with just a C and an F and a C. And you played it, you said.
Not this one, no.
Oh, not this one. I'm sorry. It was a different song, I guess it was.
Yeah.
But the sort of the simplicity of it and the anthemic quality of it, I don't know. It's fun.
The biggest challenge with what you just said is just finding bandmates who will want to play a Spark song.
There you go.
It's not easy.
I'll bet not. I'm sure if you shave your mustache accordingly and go out to try to recruit them, it might be even a little harder.
Yeah.
There's some interesting stuff in there, just sonically. You know, you've got that right where you would hear the middle eight. You're hearing this jabber of a crowd. What are they all talking about? They're talking about my mustache because...
Yeah.
That's so important. Everyone loves to talk about my mustache being Ron here.
Yeah.
Bob Hogg gets to do I guess what you would call a solo.
I can hear it, yeah.
Yeah. That's neat. At the very, very end, you know, Les Boehm, he's doing a cool arpeggiated bit. They're having fun. They're having some fun musically, which is really cool. And of course, again, like so many other songs on here, it's kind of the Dave Kendrick show. Those drums are pushed way, 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 way up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is one of those albums where I love to ask you, you know, if you notice anything that stands out.
Yeah. We talked about that a little bit more on this album than on the last album. As good as he was on the last album, we talked about That's Not Nastasia and Wacky Women and all the great things that he did. But on this one, he's just very consistent and is louder, like you said. They clearly knew that that was an asset that they needed to bring out, so they were smart enough to do it. This song is a great example. The couple at the end I want to talk about where he uses some kind of inverted beats. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to listen to. It's wonderful what he does. Yeah.
And that's in this song?
No, on one of the later songs.
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, we'll get to it.
Decline and Fall of Me. Decline and Fall of Me. Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah. Nice work.
Would you like to read the lyrics?
I will. And
from, by the way, listeners who can't see.
Yes.
He's got the inner sleeve. of the LP, and on there,
as we say in Pittsburgh, where I'm from, it needs taped.
It needs taped.
It needs taped. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But a lady gets a lot of things. She gets a 20 carat ring. She gets the alimony too. She gets to look good in the nude. Another line that you probably won't see a whole lot of in a Spark song. Well, who knows? But there's one place where they've been whipped between the nose and upper lip. Yeah, it's a great, ooh, it's a great way to start a song. Mm-hmm. Mustache, mustache, 100 hairs make a man. And then he gets into it. He says, I tried a handlebar design. My Fu Manchu was real fine. My Ronald Coleman made him blink. My Pancho Villa made him think. But when I trimmed it real small, my Jewish friends would never call. That was a line that got us in trouble. But, you know, every now and then, in various songs, he likes to do these lists every now and then, you know, and this is another wonderful example of that. Then the chorus, and then the last verse is, they call me sir and that ain't bad. Sometimes they think that I'm my dad. And women flirt, and you can bet they like that tickle that they get. The only time I feel bad is when they guess the lunch I've had.
Good joke.
It's a funny song.
Joke.
Yeah, yeah, that's all it is. It's great. And you're right about that cottage industry. And not everything is. So that's one of the great things about Sparks, is they can be appreciated just for having funny lyrics, and you don't need to go all that much deeper. Yeah.
And I think that's one of those for sure. Yeah.
Sure.
But the second one is Instant Weight Loss.
Yeah.
This one is obviously not as anthemic, doesn't have that anthemic quality that so many of the others songs on the album have. It's in fact, I noticed that most of it sticks with this. Well, of course, you've got Bob Hogg's kind of stuttering, insistent riff, which I found out is in he's playing a G5 power chord there, and it's there for like most of it. So not a lot of musicality on that side of things. Ron does do some fun stuff with his keyboard stylings going up and down. Do you have anything in particular? Do you have any thoughts about instant weight loss? I didn't have a lot.
Not particularly. When I was saying last show, and I kind of hinted at this show, that the reason I've kind of gravitated toward Womp a little bit over this album is only because on Womp, from beginning to end, I love every song. And I said that I don't think that's a great criteria necessarily, but it's my criteria. And on this song, this album, I guess, you know, every song until now has been so good. And then I felt that this one and the next one weren't quite up to the same standard. And I don't want to say that because they're good songs.
No, but you and me are on the same page here.
Okay. Yeah. But I have to say the words on this one are wonderful.
Yeah.
The words are really funny.
Speaking of the words, I was trying to figure out what it means. I mean, obviously he's having sex with the woman and he loses all this weight and whatever. What's your interpretation of what's going on here lyrically?
Isn't that enough? I mean, it's a funny song. I mean, I will say this, if Saccharin in the War was his first song about dieting and this is his second song, at least this one's understandable. I have no idea what that song, Saccharin in the War, or Roger, are really about.
I have no clue.
But I know they're about diet.
Those first two albums, man. Yeah.
Oh, they're on another. We're going to have a conversation about
that. They are on another planet, yeah.
The words are funny. It's just a funny little story, and maybe it's because we expect so much out of them sometimes, you know. But I have no problem with the song. It's just, it's not one of my go-to songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds to me like something they thought maybe they had something when they were jamming and maybe this could become something, and Ron had something of an idea and there you go.
But the words, though, I mean, they're funny.
They're funny.
Really well put together words. Yeah.
What do you think's going on in the second verse with this guy with the
foreign name, the chubby hands,
the chubby hands and the gold chains? Yeah.
I don't know.
Is he a pimp of some kind? Is this some sort of a larger scam whereby this guy has hired these lovely young ladies to get this guy to lose weight? And then the foreign guy with the chains comes around and tempts him with more goodies, so he puts the weight back on, so his repeat business.
I didn't hear any of that.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean it's not there. I just heard that he did what he had to do. He lost the weight to get the girl, and then came this guy with the big chains and, you know, and the foreign accent and all that stuff, and he lost the girl.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe I'm superficial, but I just heard it as a really funny little song, you know. I didn't hear all those things that you heard. Maybe they're there. Maybe they're there.
Maybe they are there. Yeah. It's, you know, as I said before, musically, it's pretty simplistic. I mean, you got Bob Hogg, you know, playing that G5 over and over and over and over. And then there's a little bit of a change here. One night, one steamy night. I think there's a play on a E to an E minor and an E, and it just goes right back to it.
Yeah.
After that.
It's a good song. Yeah.
play that riff. Don't play that riff. That takes me back. Instant weight loss. There was this girl, black hair, so what? She called me fat. But in one night, instant weight loss. One night, one steamy night, I lose a kilo each hour. In 10 nights, 10 steamy nights, and figure a kilo an hour. Instant weight loss. Then came this guy, some foreign name, had chubby hands, wore lots of chains. Instant weight loss. That's it. What's done is done. Erase the past if you can. With ice cream, with coconut pie, in less than a week I'd undone. Instant weight loss. Play that riff. She sang that riff all through the night. It's coming back. I've gained an ounce, I've gained a pound, another pound, I've gained a ton. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum. So last July, this girl pulls up, blonde hair, so what? She says, hey fats, instant weight loss. 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 Instant weight loss.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a good song. It's fun.
It does
smile to your face.
Break up.
Yeah.
It you know, from the beginning of the album up to this point, it's felt like a raging party nonstop, and then this breaks up the momentum a bit.
Yep, absolutely.
do you have anything? I'm going to go ahead and read the lyrics unless there's something else you want to add about it.
Nah, go ahead.
All right, here we go. Oh, don't play that riff, which is kind of funny. You got Bob Hogg there.
Playing the riff.
Russ is saying, don't play that riff. Don't play that riff. That takes me back. Instant weight loss. There was this girl, black hair, so what? She called me fats. But in one night, instant weight loss. One night, one steamy night, I'd lose a kilo each hour. And 10 nights, 10 steamy nights, and figure a kilo an hour. Instant weight loss. Then, oh, I think I missed something here. Oh, then came this guy. Some foreign name, had chubby hands, wore lots of chains. Instant weight loss. That's it. What's done is done. Erase the past if you can. With ice cream, with coconut pie, in less than a week, I'd undone. Instant weight loss. Don't play that riff, sings Russ again. She sang that riff. All through the night, it's coming back. I've gained an ounce. I've gained a pound. Another pound. I've gained a ton. Pump, 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 pump. So last July, this girl pulls up. Blonde hair. So what? She says, hey, fats. Instant weight loss. It just goes out that way.
Yeah. Now, what's wrong with just a funny little song?
I know.
It's a cute, funny little song. It's Ron writing for humor, and
yeah,
it's good.
you know, I mean, maybe you could dig a little deeper and, you know, the whole weight loss craze, the fitness craze of the early 80s. People are jogging now, wearing their Walkman. And
that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, that would be, if it's a comment on anything, that's what it's a comment on. You know, that's how things were at that time. So, okay. It's a funny little comment.
Yeah. Yeah. There's your second level.
I do fear with the whole, I'm going to use the word meta, but I'm not trying to single anybody out, I promise. But I do fear with that cottage industry that sometimes it's okay to just listen to the songs and appreciate them for what they have to say.
Sure.
Because they're just funny songs, or they just have a point, you know. And I think that's what you get on a lot of these older albums. Just, yeah. They were funny guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here they were going for humor throughout the whole 80s. They wanted to be those funny guys until Music That You Can Dance To, when they started to change their tune a little bit, which is a bad pun. But
interesting. You know,
they were just interested in selling records and having fun and being part of the LA scene and being funny, kind of the, you know, little clownish. They were okay with it.
Yeah. I can't wait until we get to that album there. Because you kind of see that as the point where they started to look a little more inward.
I think with that album, but I think a lot of we'll come to all that. But I think a lot of it got put on hold. But I think even with the next album, it presaged a lot of what we see now, which I don't think I could have appreciated until looking at it now and thinking about where they are now and how. So much of what they do now is kind of captured in Outer Space. You don't get it from the songs necessarily, but you get it from the presentation and the production. But I know we're saving that discussion. But yeah, I think that next album has more. It means more to me now than it did then. That's for sure.
I can't wait to get to that. And also at this, you know, they're still cranking out an album a year. You know,
seven albums in this decade. One in the next decade.
Yeah.
Seven albums. If you include Terminal Jive.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But you're right. I know. It's. So, you know, they've got a work ethic here also, where they want to get the material out.
They love to work and they love to tour. That's it.
Hello again. Puny humans. Computer Girl here, from the song Computer Girl. You have reached the end point of this podcast episode. Just as there is nothing further north than the North Pole, there can be no more material after this statement. I mean, this one. Right here, now.